Winter Notes on Summer Impressions, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Introduction. 1. It is usual to divide Dostoevsky's literary activity into two distinct periods. The first opens with the publication in 1846 of a somewhat sentimental novel, Poor Folk, which brought him immediate literary renown, popular esteem, and the enthusiastic blessing of the great critic Bielinski. It closes with what, in effect, are his reminiscences of life as a political convict, The House of the Dead, serialized in 1861-2 in his newly founded periodical Vremya, Time. The second period, we are invariably told, is ushered in 1864 with that oddly strident confession of personal guilt and inadequacy entitled Notes from Underground, and finishes with the Pushkin commemoration address delivered a few months before his death. To state that Dostoevsky's writings fall into two fairly definite periods is, of course, to state the obvious. The author's attitude to the world, his choice of subject matter, and his treatment of plot undergo, in the 60s of the 19th century, profound change. His earlier novels aim mainly at the entertainment of the reader, undeterred by considerations of verisimilitude or psychological insight. They lack the later Dostoevskian eagerness to reconcile the actions of men with their consciences, conceived in terms of spiritual anguish. The opening of the second and more characteristic phase of Dostoevsky's literary activity was introduced not, it seems to me, by Notes from Underground, but in the previous year by a short work, no more than an essay, very little commented on hitherto. The significance of the essay, to which he gave the name Winter Notes on Summer Impressions, is quite disproportionate to its length for the light it throws on the origin and development of Dostoevsky's most cherished ideas. Dostoevsky, fresh from his first contact with Western Europe, which included a week in London and three in Paris, published in his periodical his impressions of that new and alien world, using them as a peg on which to hang a remarkable number of the ideas which henceforth entered in varying degrees into everything he wrote, often expressed in phrases lifted textually from the present book. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that he never again wrote anything which contained so many of his thoughts on so many subjects in so few pages. It was as if, on the threshold of an entirely new epoch in his writing, he had decided to present his readers with a profession of faith and a synopsis of his ideas. In fact, Winter Notes on Summer Impressions, far from deserving their Cinderella-like treatment, ought to be regarded as a chrysalis out of which developed such masterpieces as The Devils, Crime and Punishment, and The Brothers Karamazov, as well as the Journal of an Author and the figures of Father Zosima and the Grand Inquisitor. Even the Pushkin commemoration address, which was probably received with greater immediate acclamation than anything Dostoevsky had ever written, contains little that is not adumbrated in the present book. The neglect from which Winter Notes have suffered at the hands of literary critics is due to a variety of reasons. One of them, no doubt, is that it is generally regarded as a piece of journalistic reportage with no bearing on the great novels on which Dostoevsky's reputation rests, rather than as a link in his whole system of thought. Another reason may be the style of writing Dostoevsky adopted for his Winter Notes, in which repetitiveness, excessive colloquialism, forced breeziness, and waggish humour tend to predominate to the irritation of the reader. The reader must make up his mind to disregard these things. If he does, he will be amply rewarded. 2. The centre of Dostoevsky's ideas harbours a vision of the world as a moral and spiritual unity, a brotherly fellowship which must exist in nature but cannot be artificially created, as both Winter Notes and Father Zosima phrase it, and which expects, but most definitely does not demand of its members, a total responsibility for each other and for the community as a whole. It is a unity which makes each one of us into a link in the infinite chain of causation, and which, though it may relieve each individual member of the human race of total responsibility and therefore total guilt, yet thrusts upon each of us the burden of a world conscience. It is this theme which Dostoevsky later expanded into an analytical novel, Crime and Punishment, and which later still he made both his Grand Inquisitor and Father Zosima, the brothers Karamazov, develop each in his own way. The fundamental tragedy of men, according to Dostoevsky, comes from two kinds of actions. Actions that shatter world unity, and every crime committed against one's fellow men is an attempt to shatter it, as Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment finds out to his cost, and actions which attempt to attain a synthetic unity by artificial means. The latter he considers particularly dangerous, for men, consciously or subconsciously aware of the dangers of isolation, all clamour for unity, and, in default of genuine brotherhood, are all too eager to accept a counterfeit model in the shape of socialism or the Catholic Church, which can offer nothing but the brotherhood of an anthill. But, says Dostoevsky, both in his Winter Notes on Summer Impressions and in his capacity of Grand Inquisitor, the brothers Karamazov, even this men will gladly accept, for the alternative to an anthill is a struggle of all against all, ending in cannibalism, when men will devour each other. Catholicism and socialism Dostoevsky regarded as being basically the same, both of them ultimately emanations of the Roman imperial idea, which insisted on a purely mechanical, external unification of men, in the hope, at least on the part of the Catholic Church, that such a unification would in time give birth to true spiritual fellowship. The identity of Catholicism and socialism is an idea which clearly had not yet taken its final shape in Dostoevsky's mind at the time of writing Winter Notes. He was convinced then that socialism was possible anywhere but in France. Yet later on, in his journal, he argues that France is socialist already because she has a Catholic tradition, however much she may repudiate that tradition. This, thought Dostoevsky, was putting the cart before the horse, a mistake never committed by the Orthodox Church. In his interpretation, the Orthodox Church expected unity to come of itself, spontaneously and with no assistance from external human agencies. And when it came, true brotherhood would be established with no need for any rules or constitutions. In essence, of course, this is merely the Slavophile version of Russian anarchism, which was conceived as a blend of freedom and love, the former without the latter leading to anarchy as distinct from anarchism or to isolation in the Dostoevskian sense, the latter without the former not in fact able to exist. From Dostoevsky's point of view, the importance of this attitude on the part of the Orthodox Church was that the Church, after being adopted by the Russian people, made Russia forever different from the West. And it is just because the West is regarded by him as the true abode of individualist isolation, in contrast to Russia's strivings after a spiritual synthesis of the community, that the theme of Europe and her civilization recurs so frequently in Dostoevsky's writings after his return to Russia. His analysis of Western Europe, first outlined in Winter Notes and thereafter relentlessly pursued through the pages of most of his books, and particularly of his journal, presents a strange amalgam of Slavophile prejudice and Fourierist ideals, of religious utopianism and historical materialism, of traditionalist concepts expressed in terms reminiscent of the Communist Manifesto. His earlier enthusiasm for Fourier, the cause indeed of his sojourn in the House of the Dead, and his acute awareness of those social and economic forces that lie at the bottom of our cultural edifice, lead him to give certain historical events an interpretation rendered familiar to us by Marxist writings. Thus, he regards the French Revolution as a mere sham, benefiting no one but the middle classes, the bourgeoisie, at once the emanation and the creator of capitalism, whom the revolution enabled to obtain a firm grip on the proletariat in order to exploit it. The hollowness of the revolution, he says significantly enough in his journal, was exposed by the execution of Babeuf, the apostle of early communism. This attitude colours the whole of his approach to France, with which most of the present book is concerned. Like Marx, he refuses to see in the revolution's, and later the republic's, slogan, liberty, equality, fraternity, anything but a piece of bourgeois hypocrisy, a gigantic bluff. Considers, like Marx, that there can be no real freedom in Western Europe without the transference of economic power to the proletariat. Like Marx, believes that proletarians are bound to unite, form their own heap, in defence of their own interests, without the fraudulent pretence of speaking for humanity as a whole, has the true Marxist and Slavophile contempt for Western liberalism and for all forms of parliamentary government, and, like Marx again, sees in the whole network of European social policy and behaviour nothing but the bourgeoisie's frantic attempt to retain the status quo. But the proletariat, he says, is knocking at the door, and one day will force it open. Repudiated by the bourgeoisie and kept away from this world's goods, it is ready to join in the class struggle and eager to repudiate the repudiators. It is obviously a theme that haunted Dostoevsky, for having dealt with it in some detail in his Winter Notes, he returned to it and repeated it with exasperating frequency in his journal many years later. No doubt his insistence on the dire fate awaiting the Western capitalist world, though often expressed in quasi-Marxist terms, was due to highly un-Marxist causes. It was due, in fact, to the wishful thinking of a Russian nationalist obsessed by the fear of Western supremacy and suffering, like so many Russians, from an acute inferiority complex vis-à-vis the West. As a result, Dostoevsky fails to apply his semi-Marxist analysis to his own country, but, on the contrary, claims that no proletarian revolution is possible in Russia for the simple reason that the Russian proletariat is not only contented, but is becoming increasingly so. He does, however, in his Winter Notes and later in his other works, raise one point, one of the most interesting in the present book, because touching upon perhaps the most fateful of all Russian 19th-century weaknesses, more objectionable in Dostoevsky's view than some of the worst excesses of serfdom, and more destabilizing in its effect than inequalities of income, the inequalities of culture, which split the country in two and resulted in the loss of contact between the educated classes and the peasantry. It was, he felt, this loss of contact which led to lack of understanding on both sides, to an attitude of supercilious superiority or guilty fawning on the part of the educated classes, and a half-sullen, half-contemptuous withdrawal into their own community by the peasants, to the treatment of the latter by the former as if, to quote Dostoevsky, they were enemy tribes. It led to the rootlessness of the intelligentsia. It led to the Slavophile movement, which had Dostoevsky's full and active sympathy, but whose ridiculous sides, like the wearing of bogus national dress to placate the enemy tribes, he was quick to perceive, and it led to the phenomenon of westernizing expatriates, Russians who felt more at home in Western Europe than they did in their own country, where they found no congenial occupation for themselves, stayed out of Russia as much as they could, and were a constant butt for Dostoevsky's rather heavy-handed sarcasm. In the following century, it may have been a contributory cause of the Russian Revolution. 3. The Marquis de Custine, whose very brief stay in Russia preceded Dostoevsky's visit to Paris by a whole generation, and resulted in a book perhaps more often quoted than read, was shocked by the lack of freedom in Russia, the ubiquity of police informers, the arbitrariness of government, and the slavish adulation of the emperor. He ascribed it all either expressly or by implication to national character, as well as to the country's remoteness from the civilizing influence of Western Europe in general, and of France in particular. When, a quarter of a century later, in the summer of 1862, Dostoevsky came to Paris, he too was shocked. And what shocked him, so he confesses or implies in his Winter Notes, was lack of freedom in France, the ubiquity of police informers, the arbitrariness of government, and the slavish adulation of the emperor. He ascribes it all to national character, which produced the French bourgeois with his servile mentality. The impact made on Dostoevsky by this country was strikingly different. For the moment, for he vacillated in this, he despised the French, and Paris, he wrote to a friend, bored him to death. But London overwhelmed him. True, the picture he draws of it and of the British social scene is somehow reminiscent of Gustave Doré's illustrations for Dante's Inferno, and he is driven to describe it in apocalyptic terms. But at least there is no room in it for the meanness and pettiness which he found across the Channel. It is curious, too, that his judgment of the two countries completely reverses the more usual view, accepted as axiomatic by the world at large. It is France, not England, in his estimation, that is a nation of shopkeepers. And it is France that is hypocritical when it comes to moral standards, for she tries to slur over and, if possible, hide certain distasteful facts of life, such, for instance, as irregularity of sexual behaviour, commercial dishonesty, and the presence of poverty in the midst of plenty. Dostoevsky's England has her share of social vices, but they are there for everyone to see. No attempt is made to conceal them. In fact, if France's outstanding trait is hypocrisy, England's is pride. It is clear, of course, that Dostoevsky did not form his impressions of England unaided. A week's stay in London could not have either supplied him with the necessary material or given him a sufficient insight into the British character, particularly as he knew no English. He admits to his ignorance of the language in one passage of the present book, yet in another claims to base certain of his conclusions on English newspaper reports. The only man Dostoevsky is known to have visited in England was Alexander Herzen, the exiled Russian journalist of radical views, a sparkling personality and a brilliant talker, whose opinion of the Russian government Dostoevsky did not share, but whose views of the English character and customs he evidently found congenial. It is Herzen's views, therefore, that, more likely than not, form the basis of Dostoevsky's analysis of the English character and of life in this country. But quite apart from his influence on Dostoevsky's views about this country, Herzen is responsible for much of the contents of Winter Notes, as well as for the form in which they were cast. The perusal of his letters from France and Italy makes this abundantly clear. For these letters have suggested to Dostoevsky many of his reflections on Russia and his few remarks on Germany, and provided him with some of the more biting images which he used in order to illustrate his comments on the French contemporary social scene and the bourgeois mentality and habits. In general, Dostoevsky was readily influenced by contemporary thinkers, and the game of tracing his ideas back to their original sources is not hard to play. Thus, Petrushevsky inspired him with his early enthusiasm for Fourier, which, for all his later scoffing, continued to colour his vision. His concept of universality as the most typical attribute of the Russian character was probably first suggested to him by Bielinski, who himself owed it to Adoyevsky. His notion of true brotherhood, realizable through a spontaneous integration of society and the individual, is similar to Konstantin Aksakov's and to Hamyukov's. Samarin is partly responsible for his view of the Orthodox Church as the synthesis of the Roman Catholic principle of unity and the Protestant principle of freedom. The two alternatives of anthill and cannibalism are derived from Herzen. So is much of the language he uses to express his social and political philosophy, though there Petrushevsky's contribution looms large indeed. While, insofar as it differs from Herzen's, his view of the West, its individualism, materialism, and impending calamitous decline, and of Russia's special place in the comity of nations and almost in the universe, her self-contained civilization and messianic destiny can be found in all essentials in early Slavophile literature. Dostoevsky's failure entirely to fuse all these disparate elements into one properly integrated whole till very late in life resulted in an ambivalence of attitude to the problems of his day, which would have been fatal to a lesser man. That it did not prove fatal is due to a combination of qualities which include sincerity, psychological insight, and immense literary gifts.